she's gone dead, cried the men who were there. And she passed up the dock on the wide Delaware. Then the ship ran aground and the oil got away. And they did not report the big spill on that day. It was hundreds of thousands of gallons galore, stretching 32 miles down the Delaware shore. There were geese in the marshes out looking for food. They got stuck.
And good afternoon and welcome to A Public Affair here on WORT, the first public affair of the year 2012. And starting off there with a little bit of Steve Forbert's song, The Oil Song, came out some 20-plus years ago, and sort of setting the tone for our conversation today. We're going to be looking at the future, looking forward from 2012, and particularly focusing on the topics of oil and a changing climate. And this program today partly grew out of a series that The Nation magazine has been running on their blog. And with me here in the studio, Nicole Foss, co-editor of The Automatic Earth, and has been chronicling and interpreting the ongoing credit crunch, among other things, as well as the situation of finance, energy, the environment, and population. We'll be talking with her during the program. Also joining us by telephone, Dmitry Orlov, an engineer and writer on subjects related to peak oil, born in Leningrad and moved to the United States at the age of 12. Orlov was an eyewitness to the collapse of the Soviet Union, and his latest book is Reinventing Collapse, and his article Closing the Collapse Gap compares the collapse preparedness of the USA and the USSR. Also joining us by telephone, James Howard Kunstler and his blog, Kunstler.com, which has predictions for 2012, and we'll be talking about those coming up in just a moment. And then finally, also joining us by telephone is Richard. I'm missing your biography here. I apologize. Richard, I'm going to have to ask Richard Heinberg to introduce himself because I don't have your bio on this printout.
Yeah, that's okay. I'm a senior fellow with Post Carbon Institute and author most recently of The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality.
Thank you very much. And James and Dmitry, if you could both each say hello as well.
Hello, Dmitry.
Let me start off with you, Dmitry Orlov, and talking about these issues of preparedness. You know, one of the things that's very much in the news right now is the threatened close of the Straits of Hormuz. And how does a single incident like that affect the preparedness or lack of preparedness of a country like the United States?
Well, there's really no plan in the United States at any level to survive a shutoff in the flow of oil of the magnitude that the Iranians could cause simply by making a plausible threat, because the oil tankers are not insured against a ballistic missile attack, I believe. So they basically would just have to stay in port. They wouldn't be able to traverse the strait once the threat is made good on. So what will probably happen is a disruption at gas stations at that level in not too long. And after that, I think a lot of supply chains will break down. Availability of goods at every level will dwindle. And so what people have to do to prepare at every level is stockpile whatever materials are needed to reboot into a very different economic mode, where you're really just relying on local sources for everything, because the global supply chain is no more.
Now, how does what's happening with the economy in Europe, particularly the euro crisis that we've been witnessing over the past year or so, how does that relate to these issues of the world economy?
Well, Europe is poised to weather dwindling oil supplies a lot better than the United States. There's first of all, it's very compact geographically. Secondly, it relies on barge and railroad transportation to a much greater extent. Thirdly, there are fewer private cars, and people rely on private automobile less. So all of those things would speak in its favor.
Mm-hmm. Now, also with us on the phone, Richard Heinberg, author of 10 books, including The End of Growth, Peak Everything, and The Party's Over. Richard, one of the things that you have written about, as I understand it, is the XL pipeline and tar sands oil. Is this something that is going to be exploited more in the coming year to try and ease this crude oil crisis? And what is the environmental cost of that?
Well, certainly the Canadians want to ramp up production from the tar sands. There's no question about that. But their ability to do so is hampered by the nature of the resource itself. Production increase is going to be slow, and it will be ultimately limited by the scale of the needed technology and the requirement for fresh water, natural gas, and other resources. We're talking about a really, really low-grade hydrocarbon here. Producing oil from the tar sands is really scraping from the bottom of the barrel. I'm not sure what the latest production figures are. I think it's in the range of a couple of million barrels per day, which is substantial for Canada. But we have to put that in context and remember that the U.S. uses something like 18 million barrels of oil per day. And Canada's ability to ramp up from that 2 million barrels a day, as I say, it's going to be a very slow process. Maybe we'll get to a maximum of 3 million barrels a day before it levels off. But we're talking about years before that will happen.
Here in the studio with me is Nicole Foss, who is co-editor of the automaticearth.blogspot.com, but formerly was also editor of the Oil Drum Canada, and runs a thing called the Agri-Energy Producers Association, focusing on farm-based biogas projects and grid connections for renewable energy. Now, you live in Canada, in the land where this tar sands exploitation is beginning. Talk a little bit about the impact of tar sands and the alternatives that your organization works with.
Well, I should point out, I no longer run the Agri-Energy Producers Association of Ontario because these days I work full-time for the Automatic Earth. I travel all over the world lecturing, so I parted company with that job April 2010. That was focusing on Ontario and the feed-in tariff programs for renewable power. And so I have taken a broader view now. So in terms of tar sands, basically the environmental cost is horrendous because the water flows north. It doesn't end up in very populated areas, so people don't realize just how horrendous some of the health impacts actually are in the people who are affected. But there are tremendous cancer rates in places like Fort Chipewyan, which is downstream from the tar sands. The main point with tar sands, however, is that the net energy is so poor that you hardly get more energy out than you put in. It's an arbitrage between natural gas that's currently cheap and Syncrude that's currently fairly expensive. You can make money at it. You're really not producing hardly any energy at all. So the environmental impact is really not as a result of exploiting a genuine energy source. This is simply a way to generate money, and it's also critically dependent on the price of oil. Now, despite the fact that the Straits of Hormuz appear to be under threat, I actually think the next move for oil prices will be down, and possibly significantly, because we're coming off the back of another speculative bubble in oil like we saw in 2008, where people had bid up the price in an advance of what the fundamentals would justify. I think we're on the verge of seeing a breakdown in those prices now as speculation goes into reverse, and then demand starts to fall as the Chinese bubble is bursting as well. So I actually think oil prices will fall, and that will mean that basically everything in the tar sands is uneconomic. Plus, the natural gas that's required is also going to be problematic. Shale gas is an absolute mirage. Right now, they're using what's left of conventional natural gas, a whole gas field from northern Alberta, for the purpose of tar sands. But conventional natural gas in North America peaked in 2001 when we realized we actually do not have 100 years worth of shale gas sitting in the wings. We might have five. Then all of a sudden we're going to realize natural gas is not going to be cheap in the future. That arbitrage will no longer work. So the economics of tar sands get completely blown out of the water in the next few years. I don't think that pipeline will ever be built, because by the time you could possibly build it, the demand won't be there and the money to build it won't be there either.
We're kind of drifting into the area of predictions, and so I want to bring in now James Kunstler, who's also joining us by phone. His books include The Long Emergency and The Geography of Nowhere, and he's also written a number of works of fiction as well. James Kunstler, you have a blog at Kunstler.com, K-U-N-S-T-L-E-R, and you just put up your 2012 predictions a few moments ago, I guess, on that blog, and it begins with the phrase "a bang and a whimper." Talk to us about the 2012 forecast.
My theme du jour is wishful thinking, and it's the subject of my next book. It seems to me that our society is getting absolutely lost down a rabbit hole of wishful thinking about how technology is going to provide rescue remedies for us so we can continue running Walmart and Walt Disney World in suburbia by other means. And we don't have any other plan besides that, and it's not a plan. So we're just going to get into a lot of trouble.
So talk about these rescue remedies, because we just heard a little bit about the idea of biogas as an alternative to oil, and of course we had the brief flirtation with green economy here in the U.S. At least the promise of a green economy. What about these technological solutions to a climate problem?
Well, more to the point, why do people who ought to know better speak about these things so untruthfully, including the President of the United States and the Secretary of Energy? You know, when the President of the United States comes out, as he did last February, and tell the public that that we have 100 years worth of shale gas, you know, he's simply putting over a false story that is going to give people a very unrealistic view of what their future is going to be like, and doing a tremendous disservice to them. And the idea that Stephen Chu, the Secretary of Energy, would advise him to say that is just unbelievable. However, I think the cognitive dissonance that now clutters up our collective mind space is so tremendous that we simply can't think clearly about these things. And there, the environmental movement is an interesting case in point. I went to the Aspen Environmental Forum for 2 years in a row, and I'm going again next June. And whenever the subject of our oil problem comes up, or you know, our car dependency problem, the only thing that they want to talk about is running all the cars differently, by other means. They don't want to talk about walkable neighborhoods. They don't want to talk about inhabiting the landscape differently. They don't want to talk about public transit. They don't want to talk about fixing the conventional railroad system because, by the way, we're not going to put together a high-speed rail system. We missed the boat on that one. And forgive me for the mixed metaphor, but you know, all these other nations were able to do that because they got in during the window of the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, when there was still a lot of capital in the world. And now we're facing a problem of capital scarcity that will be every bit as challenging for us as the energy resource scarcities we face. But my point, getting back to my point, when the cream of the environmental movement at the Aspen yearly environmental forum cannot think clearly about our predicament, you know, who are you going to turn to do the thinking for your society? So it's kind of disgraceful that that is the tenor of the conversation we're having about our predicament.
kind of a dark scenario. Dmitry Orlov,
it's not a dark scenario. It's a portrait of how we are behaving in reality. It's not a fairy tale.
Okay. I'm not questioning whether it's a fairy tale, but I'm saying it's dark in the sense that it sort of says we missed the boat. Do we have a chance to recover that boat? Let me toss it back to Dmitry Orlov. What do we need to do to be prepared for these coming energy crises?
Well, we need to get started, and I think part of getting started is getting over this mental difficulty where uncontroversial facts are too distressing for most people. So you cannot actually speak about them in public. Very few people I have found can get past very simple statements of fact about energy, about the climate. Really can't talk about it, and this is peculiar to the United States to a large extent. I've seen similar things in Russia, for instance, where climate change denial is pretty rampant. But in Europe, for instance, people are much more receptive and much more able to deal with the facts as they are and then base their decisions on them than here in the United States. And I'm not a mental health professional, so I can't really offer any advice on that. I rely on people being able to take facts on board. And if they can't do that, then I can't work with them. And that's a big problem for me right now.
Richard Heimberg, Peak Everything and The Party's Over are titles of some of your books. Is the party over, and what are we going to do about it?
Well, as you've been hearing, I think the likelihood of a coherent national government-led strategy to adapt to the end of cheap energy and to the end of easy credit and so on is just not going to happen. I think all of us on this phone and many others have been working for years to try to increase public understanding of these issues, and I've certainly, walked the halls of Congress and knocked on doors of senators and congresspeople and tried to, help them get to understand some of these things. But it's we're working against public perception and also against those who would manipulate public perception. There was an article in Wall Street Journal a few weeks ago now, which pointed out that the U.S. is now exporting more refined petroleum products than it's importing. And this is a pretty trivial matter because we're talking about a few hundred thousand barrels a day, and it's just a matter of refinery capacity and so on. But it was framed in such a way as to make readers think that the U.S. is now exporting more oil than it's importing, which is certainly not true. We're still importing, 12 million barrels a day or something like that. But this has been taken up by news sources all around the country as a fact. And just over the Christmas vacation, I was with in-laws in New Orleans, and at a party, and someone comes up to me and says, "Well, what do you think about the fact that now the U.S. is exporting more oil than it's importing?" And it took me 5 minutes to explain the situation to this person, but multiply that by millions, and you get some idea of the misperception, the misunderstanding that's been deliberately sown in the American psyche. So, once again, I have to agree with my colleagues that the likelihood of our, coherently understanding all of this and working our way out is vanishingly small, which means that it's really up to individuals and households and communities to do the best we can under the circumstances and not give up efforts to try to change perceptions and change policy and so on. But I think we have to assume the worst.
Dmitry Orlov, I know that you have to leave in a couple of minutes, so I'm just going to let you jump in here real quick and tell us what lessons can we learn from looking at what happened to the former Soviet Union.
Well, I've been looking at that angle for a long time, and I think that Richard is absolutely right. We should not expect any sort of preparation or any reasonable program to emerge at the national level. So my hopes right now are that it is possible to convince some people who have financial resources to invest in the remnants of industrial production that will be needed to bootstrap into a new mode of local production, cottage industry, to provide for people's needs when the imports are not there and when the local supply chains is all that remains because the global ones have gone away. It remains to be seen whether it is possible to talk sense to people who have access to financial resources. I'm not convinced that's going to work, but I don't see what else would.
Okay, Dmitry Orlov, engineer and writer on subjects related to peak oil, born in Leningrad and moved to the United States at the age of 12. His latest book, Reinventing Collapse, his recent article, Closing the Collapse Gap, Comparing Preparedness of the United States and the USSR. Thank you so much for joining us on this program. Our other guests will stay with us throughout the hour, and we'll be bringing in another special guest in just a moment. But I want to toss this now to Nicole Foss. And, you know, for me, one of the interesting issues, I remember doing some programs around the anniversary of Earth Day back in 1990 and kind of comparing, you know, what did recycling mean in 1969 versus what it meant in 1989. 1969, recycling meant you took your glass jar, you washed it out, you brought it back to the co-op, and you filled it again. 1989 meant you handed that jar to someone else who smashed it up, reprocessed it, and turned it into a new glass jars. A whole shift, I think, in the mindset of what green and sustainable and recycling and everything else meant. Now here we are 20 years after that, and it seems like the word green economy is the buzzword, and people look at these technological solutions, and yet all of them are ultimately, I think, based in a capitalist market economy. What about the question of oil and the question of peak oil in particular, and is there a technological solution that gets us out of this? Is biogas part of that?
Biogas isn't an energy source if you do it properly. It's a way of reducing energy throughput. So you capture the energy from high energy waste streams and you use that rather than simply seeing it all be landfilled. So it doesn't help you in the sense of providing a new energy source. Neither do most of the things that are being discussed at the moment because the net energy is simply so low. Some of them can be very useful in small niche applications. You can use ethanol on farms, for instance, made locally. You can use wood gas to run a tractor, but you don't run an industrial society on it. Not one of these things will scale up to be able to deal with the level of demand we currently have. This is really our problem. A friend of mine, Nate Higgins, has said we don't so much have a shortage of energy as a long edge of expectations. And that really is the heart of the problem. We expect to continue business as usual. Business as usual will not be possible under circumstances where energy is constrained. It determines what is physically possible to do. It is the capacity to do work. There is no way to decouple economic growth from the availability of energy. If you do not have a certain amount of energy, you're not going to be able to do what you've done before. And when Dick Cheney said that the American lifestyle was not negotiable, I would say that's true because reality isn't going to negotiate with you. It's going to dictate. And there are many things we can do energy-wise. Not one of them is a solution in the sense of getting us business as usual. We have to adjust the way our society runs at a much simpler, more low-energy level. And having done that, we can then hope to supply those much lower levels of demand.
Nicole Foss joining us here in the studio. Also on the phone, James Kunstler, his blog at kunstler.com, predictions for 2012, and also Richard Heinberg, author of numerous books, including Peak Everything and The Party's Over, also joining across the country. And it happened in a very short period of time. comparing that to what did or didn't happen in terms of green energy and so on and so forth in the early days of the Obama administration, let me toss this to you, James Kunstler, because you were talking about how we haven't had the national will to move forward on these basically reforms to our system of energy consumption, and that maybe now it's too late.
Well, what we're seeing is a campaign to sustain the unsustainable, largely because we have made overinvestments in it, and we are stuck in the psychology of previous investment. We have spent our national treasure on building the suburban living arrangement. And the most characteristic thing about it is that it has no future because we're not going to be able to power it and get around in it and use it. And there's so much of it, and it's become so entwined with our national identity that we can't even think about reforming it or letting go of it. And so all of our efforts are now being bent in the service of sustaining this living arrangement that has no future.
Mm-hmm. James Kunstler, author of, among other things, The Geography of Nowhere and The Long Emergency. Let me ask you, Richard Heinberg, your area of research and your books, including The End of Growth, have talked about the urgent need to transition away from fossil fuels. How can this message be gotten out to people in a way that it's palatable?
Well, with great difficulty, as I was saying earlier, it's in terms of general perception, the U.S. is moving toward, as Professor Chomsky said, energy independence. That's the perception. The reality is something very different from that. Looking, for example, at the Bakken Shale in North Dakota, the perception that's being sown in the general American psyche is that this is an enormous boom, and it's just taking off now. And within a few years, North Dakota will be basically powering the rest of the country, and shale oil from other places will come on and online, and we'll be exporting oil to the rest of the world. This is a meme that you can find in Wall Street Journal and conservative news outlets, and even in some sort of mainstream liberal news outlets. And you start looking closely at what's actually going on, and the picture is very, very different. Actual production in North Dakota is something like 500,000 barrels a day. Again, U.S. uses 18 million barrels of oil per day. Well, this is significant for North Dakota. I mean, North Dakota has never produced anything like 500,000 barrels of oil per day before. But what is the actual potential for ramping that up? Well, it may get to possibly twice what it is today, and that's a very, very optimistic forecast. More likely 600,000, 700,000 barrels a day before production levels off and starts to decline within the next 4 years or so. Looking at different areas around the country, basically the same situation. Now, we've had this before. U.S. oil production peaked in 1970, started to decline, and very soon there was a big boom with the North Slope of Alaska, the biggest new oil-producing province in U.S. history. And we're still seeing production from North Slope, but it's been declining for the last couple of decades, and it's continuing to decline, and it will decline to nothing. The North Slope provided a little bump on the way down as U.S. oil production has continued to generally decline over the past 40 years. Same thing with the oil from Gulf of Mexico. Huge claims for deep water and ultra-deep water in Gulf of Mexico. And that province is still increasing, but probably only for the next 3 or 4 years, and then we'll start to see declines beginning there. So we're grasping at straws, in fact, but the public perception is that we're on the verge of abundance and bounty. So as long as that public perception is being managed in such a way as to prevent people from seeing what's really going on, I think it's very difficult to change people's minds and change people's behaviors. So what ends up happening is that there's a serious conversation among people who do understand energy issues, and there are many, many thousands of them, tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands around the country. And people are doing sensible things. They're becoming more energy independent in terms of their households. They're growing more of their own food. They're getting in touch with their neighbors and starting to think about contingency possibilities and so on. For the country as a whole, I see very little prospect of a change in energy policy that would bring us closer to reality.
What about these small movements for change? Nicole Foss, in Canada, is there more support for alternative energies and growing your own food than there is here in the States per capita, obviously? And, you know, you talked earlier about things that you can't scale up. And that's always an issue, I think, is what can be scaled up and what has to happen sort of bioregionally.
Actually, I find in Canada, although there are some things that are being done, like there's a feed-in tariff program for renewable power in Ontario, it's not going to make any difference because there isn't the available grid capacity. So what it can deliver is actually really limited. I find that in a lot of ways in Canada, there's very low awareness of a lot of the things that I write and speak about, you know, energy and finance, because there's this sense that Canada's an energy superpower. These are other people's problems. And Canada's living in an enormous property bubble at the moment. When you're at the height of a bubble, you don't see it for what it is. So I actually spend almost no time in Canada because there's almost no audience there for looking at, you know, questioning the assumptions that our society is built upon. So I spend far more time in the U.S. and Europe. It's not just a question of scale. It's also absolutely critical to underline net energy when it comes to looking at these energy sources. When the net energy is really low, so the energy profit ratio is minimal, you get hardly more out than you put in, then you do not have something that is effectively an energy source. Their net energy will define what is and is not an energy source for any given society. You have to look at the energy profit ratio our society is based on, and if we have less than that, we are forced to simplify. So all these sources of energy that people talk about, it's not just a matter of scale, it's a matter of the net energy. What did you have to put in to produce what they produced in North Dakota? It's an enormous amount of energy. So this is not leading to energy independence. But oil shale is being used in the way that shale gas was, in a sense to create this enormous hype that all of a sudden we're swimming in energy. This is going to crash prices for oil. It's going to be part of crashing price for oil, along with speculation going into reverse and a lot less demand in China. The perception of glut will drive prices down. When we had the perception of scarcity, it drove prices up in advance of the fundamentals. We then had a 78% fall in 2008 as the speculation went into reverse. We're on the verge of something like that this time. That whole hype will play into the perception of glut and result in prices crashing, so that a lot of the alternatives will never get off the ground because they simply are too expensive to operate in competition with oil prices that low. And prices can crash even although we are facing imminent scarcity. Natural gas is a perfect example. The perception of shale gas hype has crashed prices to the point where almost all shale gas is being produced uneconomically. These companies are piling on massive amounts of debt. They're taking huge financial risks. They're not even going to be there probably in a few years' time. And when we realize that we probably have perhaps 5 to 10 years of shale gas, not 100, all of a sudden that perception of glut will go away, but then it will be too late to do anything about it, and we'll realize we were in a natural gas crisis all along. The same thing will happen with oil just a little bit further down the line. We're in the process of creating the perception of glut, which is completely untrue. That will crash prices for a while at the expense of making it drastically worse later when we haven't got the supply later on when we need it. And we really are facing monetary issues as well. We haven't really looked at that today, but this is a lot of what I write about, the effect of the credit crunch simply taking the money out of the system so that capital will be incredibly scarce. All the complex, expensive techniques for producing energy rely on vast amounts of capital and also the stability to be able to, the economic visibility to say, this project has a 20, 30, 40-year timeline. This is what I expect to make in terms of profit, so I will make the decision to go ahead with this. When you get to a visibility of next to nothing, maybe weeks if you're lucky, you don't make those investments. So you crash supply down the line because you crash investment in the process. We haven't really seen anything in terms of credit crunch yet. It is absolutely coming. It's starting in Europe. So that contagion is very much going to be spreading around the global banking system. 2008 didn't tell us really anything about what a credit crunch really means. This time we're going to find out. 2012 will be the beginning of finding out what that really means. And it is going to drive what happens in the energy sector enormously.
And that's Nicole Foss, co-editor of the blog, theautomaticearth.blogspot.com.